The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network.
You found the most positive place on the internet. Thanks for listening to UnityOnlineRadio.org.
Are you ready to create a life that's intentional and dynamic? Welcome to the Intentional Spirit with your host, Reverend Temple Hayes.
And welcome, everyone, and thank you for being with us today. And more importantly, thank you for being an intentional spirit. We know very clearly that being an intentional spirit is somewhat expanded beyond setting goals or New Year's resolutions, because an intentional spirit keeps walking on their journey and their path of life, shamanically, really, when you think about it. And we really believe that life's events and circumstances help shape-shift us to become more in our lives and a greater contributor to this planet. None other today than our incredible guest, as we have Claude Anchin with us today. Claude, welcome. Wonderful Zen master. You are just a blessing to this planet, and you have so much to say, and I'm so delighted that you're here. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. And would you prefer that I refer to you as Reverend Hayes, or may
Temple.
I call you
Temple?
Great.
Yep.
Thank you for having me on the show, Temple, and really thank you to all the people who listen in to you. Where would you like to begin?
Well, you know, I find that our listeners are tuning in from all over the world, either live time now or later. And I find that what is the richness and the pearl and the reassurance to people listening is that often we'll see, you know, someone like you or Temple Hayes, like with an organization or a foundation or, you know, whatever, in our humble spirits that we are. And they think, well, we just went from A to B. And that's not the case. You know, we've had this journey of life that's shaped us. We've had the kind and unkind moments of our lives. And I think it's wonderful. Claude, can I call you Claude? Is that okay? And
sure.
All our information will be featured, you know, that people can read all about you and your bio. As a matter of fact, we've already promoted it today. But that being said, to tell us a little bit about the start of your life and your journey and how you got involved in being a Zen monk, what led you on this path to your Zaltho organization, all of this and everything else you want to tell about you and your work.
And thanks. I'd be glad to.
Okay.
First, I will explain that I am a fully ordained Zen Buddhist monk. And so I experience the world. I sort of rather understand my experiences in the world from a particular angle of perception. Now, I was born in a very small rural farming community. I grew up in a very small rural farming community in Northwest Pennsylvania, a place called Waterford. It's just south of Erie. I was actually born in Meadville, which is about 35, 40 miles south of Waterford. My father was a school teacher. My mother she did domestic work. She also worked in restaurants, those sorts of things. My mother was quite young when I was born. She was 17, and she turned 18 days after I was born.
Oh, wow.
My father had been a soldier in the Second War. My grandfather had been a soldier in the First War, and my great-grandfather had been a soldier in the war with, we call it the Spanish-American War. In Spain, they call it something different. So in the patriarchal lineage of my family, there was a history of military combat service. My mother's side of the family, I don't know so much about. She didn't know her father. And so I never got to know my maternal grandfather. I only knew my maternal step-grandfather. And he was a restaurateur. He was a business guy. I My father was very well liked in the, well, let's say he was active in the community, and on the surface of things, he was well liked. My father taught driver education and American history, although his master's degree was in biochemistry. Such is the call when you need a job, you know. And my father was active in the politics of education. At one time, he was the president of the Pennsylvania State Teachers Association. That demanded that he was away from home a lot. In the community, my father served on the town council. He was a volunteer firefighter. He was an EMT, sort of the predecessor of the EMTs today. However, my father died at the age of 53 from alcoholism.
Oh, wow.
Yes. My parents divorced when I was 11. And what happened is my father was in a VA hospital, and my mother packed up the house and left, took my sister and I with her. Now, in the family where I grew up, there was a lot of tension, and there was a significant amount of violence. I experienced some pretty horrendous episodes of violence as a child. And my mother was the primary perpetrator of that violence, although my father was not absent from it. It just wasn't so consistent from him. My father was more absent. Now, when my mother left my father, she took me with her, and I didn't want to go. So I started at that time. She moved to a place called Avon Lake, Ohio. It's a western suburb of Cleveland. Mm-hmm. It's between Cleveland and Lorain. It's also up on the lake. Now, I was insistent upon wanting to go back home. I don't know how I framed it, because as I'm sure you're aware, and your listening audience is aware, that memory is only a distant cousin to truth. I mean, I don't
beautiful.
Really.
What a great way of saying that.
Oh, thank you.
Memory is a distant cousin to truth.
Yes.
That's awesome. What a statement.
Thank you.
Yes.
I kept pestering my mother to let me go back to live with my dad. It was not so much that I wanted, I don't know if it was so much that I wanted to live with my dad, but I wanted to be back in my community. That's where all my friends were. That's where my safety was. And she refused. And then I started to run away from home. And at one point, to prevent me from running away, they put me in my bedroom. They locked the door. They nailed the window shut and locked the door. Now, they couldn't keep me in there. They had to let me go to school. So my mother wouldn't let me go on the bus, because on one occasion, I went to take the bus and my mother dropped me off. As soon as she left in the car, I took off. Now, so my solution, my mother would drive me to school. She would sit in the car and wait till I walked in the door. And I would sort of lurk in the hallway watching. And as soon as she drove away, I'd take off. Mm-hmm. As a result of my running away, I ended up spending some time in juvenile detention as a runaway. And eventually my mother did let me go back and live with my father. Now, because my father was active in the politics of education, and because He and his dependence on alcohol really made his decisions for him. He wasn't around very much. So from the age of 12 on, I was making up my own rules. And I didn't have really a strong family network to help me sort of navigate adolescence and decide and have us. I just had to make stuff up. There were some positive things about that. It wasn't all negative. For example, in the high school where I went, so it was grade 7 through 12, there were like, I don't know, 1,500 kids, 7 through 12. It was very small. And I remember as a young boy growing up in the sort of early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, in school, I reached a point where I had a choice. I had to take either metal shop or woodworking. I didn't want to do either. I wanted to take home economics because I was living alone and having to take care of the house. And so when I said, look, I want to take home economics, the school wouldn't let me. But because my father was a teacher at the same school where I went, this is one of the times that it was to my advantage. So I did end up taking home economics. I also took business courses. I learned how to type, those sorts of things, because it was, and it was more for my own survival, because I had to take care of myself. Those skills have served me as I've gone through life. But all in all, I was a very lost and confused young boy. Athletics saved my life. They helped keep me, well, I don't say my life, they helped keep me in school. And they were the one thing that, they were a grounding place for me. But in reflection, I experience organized athletics, like football, baseball, wrestling, basketball, those sorts of things, as paramilitary training. If you listen to the language of organized sports, if you look now at professional sports, if you watch even the Super Bowls coming up, if you watch how this thing is marketed, jets fly over, and this is language, a lot of military language there. And then because of my father's, because of this patriarchal lineage of military service, my father was encouraging me to go into the military. What he told me was that I was too unsteady to really go to college right out of high school, and that the military would help ground me, make a man out of me, and then there would be the GI Bill that could help me pay for college. I joined the military. I joined the military when I was still in high school. They had a program called delayed enlistment. So
you
I was still
in the Army, weren't you?
Yeah, I was in the Army. Yeah, I did. I joined the Army in 1965 on the delayed enlistment program. So when I graduated from high school, I had about a month or so, and then I went right into the military. And I had all these notions about military service, but when I actually got off the bus, it was the reality of the experience was quite different from my imaginations. Mm-hmm. And I understood when I got off the bus, I didn't want to be there. People were screaming at me and ordering me around, and I didn't have any movement or choice. It's like all of a sudden, all of my freedoms were taken. What I called freedoms, they were all taken away from me.
Sure.
So my early experiences, like through military training and stuff, were really difficult for me. I got into trouble, and I had a very difficult time in the military in the beginning. I completed my training, and I was sent to Germany for some advanced military training, and when I was in the military. Let's say, okay, so myself, I developed, I also developed a problem with alcohol. So while I was in high school and playing sports, I wasn't a regular drinker, but when I would pick up a drink, I couldn't stop. So if I had one, I got drunk. And when I got drunk, I got into trouble. That escalated in the military because there wasn't any age limit. I could just drink as much as I want whenever I wanted. And so this drinking issue carried over with me into my training in Europe. And I started to get into trouble with my drinking. I started to get in trouble with my drinking. My solution to that was to volunteer to go to Vietnam. So I volunteered at a young age to go to Vietnam. It was immediately accepted. I went to Vietnam in 1966. At the sort of right in the midst of this, the big escalation of troop presence there, I went over as an unattached infantryman, and I ended up being assigned to an assault helicopter company as a door gunner. I served as a door gunner for about a month and a half or so, and then there was we had a shortage of crew chiefs. And I had a high mechanical aptitude on the battery of tests that I took when I came in. They asked me if I wanted to be a crew chief, and I immediately said yes, because I was hooked on the narcotic of war. I was hooked on the adrenaline rush that accompanied being under intense fire, enemy fire, when coming into a landing zone where with no place to hide, no security, nothing. We were just targets. But there was a real intensity about that experience that is really addictive in nature. I was shot down five times. I was wounded. Yes, thank you for that. Five times is a lot, but it's not as much as some. It's more than some and not as much as others. Helicopters in Vietnam were the workhorse of that military campaign. They provided, because of the nature of the terrain the war was being waged in, vehicle movement was difficult. So the helicopters really played a major role. I spent a significant amount of time in military hospital as a result of injuries I received in Vietnam. And I left military hospital and was discharged from the military in 1968. I had reconstructive surgery in my upper body, and how they were dealing with pain management at that time is that I was being given regular doses of morphine and also some other kinds of medications. Other kind of medications were available to me in pill form. So when I was discharged from the military, they didn't detox me. I left with a serious dependence on narcotics, and that sort of set a tone for my life. I got out of the military. I started college. I didn't have the grades really to get accepted in college. My father had been a graduate of Slippery Rock State College. It's now Slippery Rock University. It's in Pennsylvania. And so he went down as an alumni and spoke on my behalf, and they admitted me on a probationary basis. And so I started to college at Slippery Rock. I didn't fit anywhere after the war.
I can't imagine. I can't fathom. You know, sometimes, people in our society, they can come across like they're so due, or, you know, the world owes me, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I just can't imagine. I took the safe route. I grew up with a rageaholic. Not an alcoholic, but sometimes alcoholics are easier because at least you know when they're going to change. Where with a dad that's a rageaholic, you don't know when the next explosion is going to happen. And that being said, it's interesting that I took the safe route. I became an Army reservist.
Oh, yeah.
And I was in that structure like you're talking about like, I was just disappearing in uniform and the inability to ever use my own mind because I was told 24/7 what to do. But that being said, it falls so pale into, I just can't imagine, you know, what it would be like. You know, people feel inconvenience when they have to wait at a traffic light because the car isn't moving fast enough in front of them. And I'm not meaning to sound cynical today, but I mean, let's be real, right? But to go through what all of you did in Vietnam, it's just, you know, unfathomable to me. I thank you for serving. My heart is so humbled by who you are. And it just brings tears to my eyes, you know, of what individuals like you went through. And then, you know, you mentioned it like, well, I went to the mall. Well, you know, I was shot at 5 times. And I mean, oh my gosh, what integration. I guess in all of this, I want to say the integration that has been required to me of your soul and your spirit and your personality to be who you are today. I just say, wow. I'm very humbled and honored to be with you today, sir.
Well, thank you. Well, it was a bumpy road. It's a work in progress. So I look at my life in a broad brushstroke, I say there's the war before the war, and the war after the war. So I grew up in family violence. I translated into the war, and then after the war, the only way I knew how to deal with conflict was to escalate the conflict to a point where the other person just got afraid. They couldn't handle it because I didn't care. I mean, I didn't care whether I lived or died in a real world way. My life was consumed by homelessness and drug addiction and violence for a long period of time. It's interesting enough, though, I did manage to get a bachelor's of education from Slippery Rock. Addiction made my choices for me. The suffering that I was living with was coloring the way in which I viewed the world. It was also shaping my decisions for me. I was completely unaware of that. So through a series of events, I ended up living in Massachusetts, and through a series of events, I ended up in psychotherapy with an MD psychiatrist. And I remember sitting in his office one day and complaining because he asked me first, he said, if I used drugs and drank alcohol, and I said, yes. And he said, if you want the process to work, you have to stop. Can you stop? I said, sure. I lied to him. I didn't have any intention to stop. So for 27 months, I was going to therapy while I was still drinking and using other drugs. And because he didn't call me on anything or he didn't notice, he didn't call me on anything. I just assumed he didn't notice. And so I was just, my mind said, see, he's crazy. He doesn't know what he's talking about. This stuff doesn't really affect me. Wasn't true. But eventually I was in his office complaining that I couldn't meet anyone like me who wasn't drinking and using drugs without going to hanging out in bars or going to parties. And and he suggested that I go to a meeting with people who had a commitment to not drink or use other drugs so I could meet people like me. I didn't have a response to that. You know, so I went and I met someone there, and they told me that my largest problem was the first fix pill or drink. And that if I were to stop getting high, that these other external things that seemed problematic to me would take care of themselves. Mm. And it sounded too simplistic to me. And I rejected the notion of it, but eventually I did go to a treatment center for a drug and alcohol dependency. I didn't go there to stop drinking or using other drugs. I went there to escape from the world wasn't doing what it was supposed to do. If it would only do what I knew it was supposed to do, I'd be okay.
Sure.
Yeah. And so I went, but halfway through this process, I realized the severity of the illness that I have, which is addiction. And I understood that there was a way in which I could address that and treat it, but that would be an ongoing basis because I learned there and I have experienced it to be true that it's a chronic, illness. And so I entered into a process of waking up, because once I took away those social anesthetics, all of a sudden, all of the feelings and that were being sort of smothered under that blanket began to burst into the open. And I had no idea what was going on. And I didn't have the skills to be willing to be able to understand or process. That's where therapy then began to be useful for me. Therapy wasn't the solution. What therapy did was give me some essential tools that enabled me to begin to navigate through this awakening that I was experiencing. I needed something else. And a social worker suggested that I go to a meditation, Buddhist meditation retreat.
Before we get into that, Claude, sure. I want us to go to our short break.
Great.
I want to invite all of you to go to his website. It's Zaltho Foundation. So it's ZALTHO.org. And he's going to talk about that and the other parts of his journey when we return. Thank you for being with us today.
We are spiritual beings having a human experience. This is UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome back to The Intentional Spirit with Reverend Temple Hayes.
In progress.
Welcome back, everyone, and thank you. And oh my, we're having just a wonderful, touching experience as we talk with a Zen monk and an amazing human, Claude Anshin Tamas. And he is touching our lives, and he is going to tell us about his foundation. He is a Purple Heart recipient. He is an incredible man and is touching us all today. So, Claude, you were just starting to talk about how you discovered meditation.
Yes. Now, I had an experience with techniques that were called meditation. I studied and taught martial arts for 27 years. And so there was a period of silent reflection. It's a bit like, I guess what I was doing was a bit like what's being defined now in the active duty military community as resiliency training, where I was being taught how to rather control my mind rather than wake up. Now, the social worker understood that sort of traditional avenues of healing that were available to me, or traditional avenues of help didn't work for me, because it was available through institutions that I didn't necessarily trust. I'm still not intensely trust. I'm still not really trusting of large institutions, but she recommended that I go to this meditation retreat that was being held for Vietnam veterans. Mm-hmm. And that it was being facilitated by a Buddhist monk, and he'd had some success in working with veterans. And it would probably might be an interesting place for me to go. I did think she was crazy. I couldn't see any possibility. It just smacked of religion to me, and I didn't want anything to do with it. However, because I wanted to protect a safe place, which was created through her support, I agreed to go. I didn't make it easy for them to accept me, but I did go. They did accept me, and. That was a, it was a, it was a, it was like another turning point in my life. So the first one was to stop taking intoxicants. And then I was introduced into this practice of breath awareness. It's more than that, but I'll keep it that simple. I was introduced into sitting meditation, and I was also instructed to understand that sitting was only a form of meditation, and that meditation in truth can't be taught. That they could give me instructions on the form. I needed to commit myself to the form. And then meditation in time would show itself to me. It would be revealed to me what meditation was. Also, I was being told consistently that once I got up off the cushion, the meditation cushion, that meditation didn't stop there. That daily life and meditation weren't two things. And so I just kept doing the next thing. This process of discovering how to live at peace with my unpeacefulness was challenging, disoriented, and at times extremely emotionally painful. It was disorienting in the fact that I would find myself. I couldn't act in the way in which I had. I had to deal with life differently, and I didn't know how to do that. So I was in this sort of this nebulous space until new behaviors began to fill that up, healthier behaviors. And I was invited to come to their monastery, so I went with the intention to visit for a month. And I ended up staying for 3 years. I left that monastery and came back to the U.S. And I was back in the U.S. about a month, and then I met the person who I'm ordained by now. So the original monastery I lived and studied at was not in the U.S. It was in France. And the monastery where I studied to become ordained in this lineage was located in Yonkers, New York. I've always had a desire to be socially active, and so I heard that there was going to be a pilgrimage from Poland to Vietnam. A group of Japanese monks were going to do that, and I saw that as a way for me to get back to Vietnam, because I just somehow wanted to really go back there under different circumstances. And so I received my novice ordination in Poland by the person who I received my full monastic ordination by. And then I walked from Poland to Vietnam. And I was sort of skeptical about this whole process of ordination and vows and all of that. But in truth, with every step that I took along this path, along this pilgrimage, I had this deep abiding sense that the path that I was embarking on, this way of living, was the best in the world for me, that it made sense. When I came back from that pilgrimage, I then founded the Zalto Foundation. That's, you announced that earlier, ZALTHO.org. Zalto, a lot of people say, well, I'm a Zen monk, and so a lot of people are trying to figure out what's the Zen reference with Zalto and what's it mean. And actually, it's an acronym for my son's name. I haven't always been a monk.
I wondered where that came from. I knew there had to be a story.
Yeah, it's an acronym for my son's name. And I named the foundation, I gave that foundation that name as in honoring all of the children of combat veterans who are also deeply and profoundly affected through the transgenerational effects of war, violence, and suffering. And so I founded the Zalto Foundation, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. It's listed as a Buddhist church, as a way to encourage people to donate money to support Vietnam veterans to go back to Vietnam. Because I said, okay, so what can I do? I ask them for money. I said, okay, if you donate here, then I can give you a tax certificate and you can get a write-off for the money that you donate to support. The foundation has grown so far beyond my wildest imaginations. The foundation does an incredible amount of work. In the past 2 years, as a result of COVID and the limitations on travel, up until COVID, I was traveling probably 260 days a year. As a result of COVID, travel was restricted. And meeting with groups was restricted. So what began to happen is I was more stationary here in the area where I'm living. And because I was more stationary, people sort of, the word got out that I was here. And so we began to do a lot of work in the local community. And I get calls to go on suicide interventions. I get calls to go on drug and alcohol interventions. These are all supported by the foundation. We set up funds with two different veterinary clinics that will support economically disadvantaged veterans who have pets who are very important in their life, and yet they can't always give them the care they need. So we've set up a fund with two veterinary clinics to support economically disadvantaged veterans that care for their pets. I'm going out and introducing myself into these homeless encampments around the area. I'm getting to know the people who live there and seeing what we can do to support them. I don't have any intention about what they need. I allow them to teach me. We also have online offerings. Every Thursday and Saturday, we have formal sittings online. This all can be found through the Zalto Foundation. The other interesting thing is that I've had the privilege to have two books published. And the first book that was published is in 2012, but it's still available. And the title of the book is At Hell's Gate, A Soldier's Journey from War to Peace. Mm-hmm. And it's available. It's available through all of the places where you can buy books. And then the second book, and this just was released, the title of the book is Bringing Meditation to Life. This book is also offered through all the various places where you can buy books. And if you want to know where they are, you can go onto the foundation's website and it will direct you. There's now a board of directors with this foundation, and it's comprised of volunteers. It's a real blue collar organization. Yet the people who on this board are extremely dedicated, bright, creative people. It's amazing the things that they've accomplished, the things that they do. We survive only on donations. We're not a wealthy foundation, and the money that comes into us, the 90% of it goes to direct services. So how can we put that money to best use in the support of communities in need? The foundation itself is not a service providing institution, but rather we like to look at ourselves as a clearinghouse. So when we identify needs, we've also gone out into the community identifying service providers that we know provide good service. And so we can direct people to places where they can get good hands-on service. Also on Sundays, on Sunday mornings at 11, I do an open session where people can join and ask any question they like. We do a question and responses. There's also a podcast channel often those question and response sessions are recorded and then put together as a podcast, and they're available on the various podcast channels. There's an Instagram and Facebook accounts for the Zalto Foundation if people are interested to know more about us. I want to keep, my effort is to keep things simple and grounded in the basic tenet that if I want my life to be different, I have to be willing to do things differently. And if I want to see, if I want there to be peace in the world, then I need to be that peace that I want to see in the world. So for me, it's not so much about changing the world or changing the institutions in the world or changing the other people in the world, but rather being willing to wake up to the roots of war, violence, and suffering in me so that they can become transformed. That transformation, that healing is not the absence of suffering. It is learning to live in a different relationship with that. So that what we used to perceive as suffering suddenly isn't. It just isn't. But that doesn't mean it's not present. And people would ask me questions when I was a lot in the public, and they would say, you know, you Buddhists are depressing. All you talk about is suffering. They thought, I want to be happy. Mm-hmm. And I go, well, that's suffering. Because if we have all of these ideas of what happiness is, and those ideas are shaped by all of that conditioning that pre-exists us, those family generations, the culture and customs, the culture and society that we're a part of, they shape our ideas of things. And then we attempt to get our life to conform to our idea of happiness, and that rarely happens. And we end up unhappy because life isn't conforming to what, it isn't doing what we want it to do.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and so the most powerful gift that I was given when I first stepped into Buddhist practice was, one, I didn't have to believe anything. Two, it didn't matter what I thought or said, it mattered what I did. And it was about simply being willing to concentrate on the breath and becoming aware of what distracted me from staying concentrated on the breath. Because as I'm able to develop a steady concentration on the breath, then the world is constantly providing me with answers of what's going on. Mm-hmm. Any question that I have is answered for me if I'm willing to just be still and listen. But for a person like me to be still, it was so painful. And because in the stillness, all of the memories and the thoughts and all of the feelings, they would just suddenly they were bubbling into consciousness. And until I developed the qualities to be able to be at peace with this unpeacefulness, I just wanted it gone. It never goes away, though. It just doesn't.
You know what, the woven fabric within the energy of your story is how, with all your experiences, you've been able to shift it to make the world a better place because you were here.
Yeah.
You know, to make it a better place because you were here, to resonate with the compassion of humanity. And I think that, you know, that I always say, and I say this often when I speak, stop blaming your parents if you're over 30 years old, you know, because come on already, you know, it can no longer be their responsibility.
What I often say publicly is what my mother did to me was criminal.
Yeah.
What I do with it, though, is my responsibility.
There you go.
Yes,
there you go.
Totally.
There you go. And it has brought, it has helped me understand, you know, family systems better. And sometimes people will say to me, you're so comfortable, you know, with confrontation. And often, you know, Temple, you're so diplomatic. And I said, I grew up in a dysfunctional family. Yeah. I had to grab the window that I had and capture the moment and say what needed to be said. So it really shape-shifted me, but truly, it's helped me understand, you know, a lot of family systems, a lot of religious systems, some of the pain of that false identification. And it's truly phenomenal what you've done with your life.
And what I what I was introduced to was that it wasn't my responsibility to change my life. It was merely my responsibility to sit down, become still, and allow that process to unfold. I have to be an active participant in that, but to allow that process to unfold and to stop attempting to control it, to really allow it to unfold. Mm-hmm. And then learn how to navigate and negotiate through that process of unfolding. And that's where the discipline of the spiritual practice that I'm ordained into serves me. And that's what I do. I simply pass that along to others. They can do with it what they want. You know, it's like, I just keep telling people, I don't care what you think, believe, or say. Like, if you embrace these tools, no matter what your religious proclivities might be, if you embrace these tools, they can take you more deeply into that. If you don't have any religious proclivities, if you're whatever is your grounding in the world, or whatever is your way of understanding, these practices can help you to go more deeply into that. And it doesn't, yeah, you just to do them. I mean, 5 minutes in the morning, 5 minutes in the evening, just sit, be still, concentrate on the breath, see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Very powerful. So where do you go from here? You know, what's next on your horizon?
Yeah, there's another book coming out, and probably in the next month. It may be shorter than that. I will continue. And what we're beginning to do now is that we're beginning to support groups of people coming together in healthy and healthy and skillful ways, so that we can learn how to live in a conscious relationship with COVID. So it's about trusting in science, not abandoning common sense, and saying, okay, so now based on the totality of experience we have over the last 2 years, how can we begin to come together in a sane and sensible way without risking each other's lives? And so we're also embarking on these processes gently, as people are willing. We have a set of protocols in place, and as people are willing, we are beginning to step back out again, or to invite people in. So that's happening, and man, I never know what's next. I really don't. Yeah, I continue to stay dedicated in the basic tenets of Zen practice. We continue the online offerings. I continue to accept invitations when they come. Predominantly, they're now online. I do what's the next thing in front of me to do. Mm-hmm. You're moving to Santa Barbara. Good luck with it.
I know. I tell you.
I have someone who's been involved with the foundation, and someone who I'm personally connected with for quite some years lives in Santa Barbara.
Oh, well, that's nice to know.
Yeah.
Maybe we can have an encounter, or do they do any kind of courses or teaching or anything? Or
currently not.
Okay.
They're active in a different. They're active in the business world.
Okay.
But they continue to invoke what they've learned to the first 10, 15 years that they were actively engaged. They bring that with them into the business world.
That's wonderful.
We now have three people who've. So the Zalto Foundation is also a referring agency for people who, a referring organization for people who might want to become chaplains. And so we have one person who is now a board certified chaplain, a Buddhist chaplain, who's serving in hospitals in Boston, Massachusetts, two separate hospitals. We have another long-term practitioner who has received their master's in social work, and they're working with veterans in the community. We have another veteran who's studying to be a chaplain who wants to work in the community of veterans. Now, we don't just work with veterans, but we also, let's see. There's just, as we continue to stay active in the world, there are different things that keep presenting themselves to us to do. I don't know what else to say.
No, I hear you. I get it. I absolutely get it. It's just wonderful work. And I want to remind everybody to go to the Zalto organization. It's ZALTHO.org and discover more about what Claude and his team, what they're actively doing and what they're working on. And I'm very pleased with both of us that we've gone almost an hour and we haven't talked about COVID. How refreshing.
Well, and that's that. I did mention it slightly.
But it just kind of blended in and it didn't stand out. And it wasn't a big banner. And,
no.
You know, because we acknowledge that it's there. We're aware. We're not in denial. But on the other hand, you know, it has taken so much power in people's lives of their thinking and like you said, the distraction and focusing on things that we have no control over, you know, can't do anything about other than, you know, being safe and mindful and, you know, all those things. But
well, that is one of the things that just briefly on that topic, one of the things that I'm working with now with the organization Zalto has sister organizations in Europe and in South America.
Okay.
And so in South America, we're also highly involved with like in Colombia with the situation there with paramilitaries and guerrillas and national soldiers and kidnapped victims and in Chile with victims of torture and abuse and so what we're working with now is in this effort to encourage people to sort of, now we have some tools to come back together, how to do that, how to not start using COVID as an excuse to not come together.
Right.
Because we can come together in safe and healthy ways. So it's now talking about how to do that. But of course I have some clear notions about that. I don't impose that on people around me, but if they want to be involved with me, then there are some pretty clear ways in which that has to be done.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Yep.
Well, I tell you, I've been a pleasure today.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed being in your presence.
Yes.
And I just acknowledge you for the work you're doing.
Thank you.
And our listeners, either in current time or in other time, will benefit and enjoy it. We'll also send you the Zoom link. And of course, there's the audio to connect on Unity Online Radio, the voice for an awakening world. For those of you that want to tune in, please join me at Temple Haze, templehaze.com. We love to hear about the guests and the different individuals you'd like to feature. And I'm sure you're going to go to Zalto to understand what it is that Claude and his group are doing. And I want to thank all of you for participating today. Thank you, Claude.
Thank you for listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
I'm Laura Worcester, host of the Intuitive Life Podcast. As an intuitive medium and teacher working with the world of spirit, I love to share the peace that comes with the awareness that our departed loved ones are still with us. And I also love to help people explore what it means to live an intuitively led life. Start listening now on mindbodyspirit.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.